Okay, welcome to our third audio segment for tonight. It's 4:19 a.m. I'm still in my office, and I'm actually having a great time sitting here talking about the book and plowing through a lot of content. And I hope this is helpful for you, and I'm interested in hearing your feedback about whether you like hearing the audio lectures or you'd rather read stuff in print. One of the problems, maybe, as a in dealing with the audio content is it's hard to speed through. You need to sit and listen to the whole thing, and it's also hard to sort of go back and listen to other things again. You may want to be taking notes, which is fine for me to tell you on the third segment so far, but anyway, you might sit back and think about some of the things that we've already talked about. And the sun has yet to rise, but I'm sure that's going to happen any minute. So let's get back to what we were talking about. I want to talk about the question of memory and how we see throughout the book, and this is one of the aspects of the novel we have not talked about yet, the ways in which Ufrid is trying to recall her past. Right? Remember I mentioned earlier, for one thing, the fact that her past is obviously not present there with her, but also seems to be missing. There's chunks that are missing, with her having been brainwashed of some sort or another, and that's also going on here. Now, we see throughout the book, from the very beginning, really, even in the first few pages, you remember you're talking about the smell of the gymnasium, scenes in which she is trying to recall her past. Now, often these memories are triggered by her senses, right, such as the smell of the gymnasium or the freshly turned earth. I think that's on page 12, the feel of that between her fingers or the sight of that, or the cracks she sees in the sidewalk, which remind her of her childhood. And there's lots of examples of seeing things in the present that trigger a memory of things that she's experienced or seen before. For example, seeing Serena Joy's face reminds her of Serena Joy's former identity. The women's magazines the commander gets for her remind her of things that she's read in the past. The smell of lemon pledge on the furniture. And you can find lots of these things and how they and follow how they trigger within Ufrid, these sort of extended memories about the life she's left behind. Now, the daytime sections in this book, remember that there's however many, nine or something like that, however many night sections in the novel. Let me just count those. There's seven night sections in the book. And the daytime sections deal with Ufrid trying to exist in this present that seemingly has no memory of the past. And these are the daytime sections are all about action, right? While the night chapters deal primarily with her mental voyages into her past, thinking back about the things she's left behind, what she's lost, her memories of her mother and Luke and her daughter, and about her attempts to regain her memory. That's the other thing that's happening in these night chapters. So the daytime is really about action, and the nighttime is about reflection, really. And if you remember, that's one of the fundamental characteristics of Sufism. And you can look back at one of those first things that I wrote to think about that. But the nighttime is this time of spiritual journey, of a quest to understand oneself, that kind of thing. And she talks on page 37, for example, about how the night is her time, right? The night is, in fact, so the only time where she feels free to one degree or another. She says, "The night is mine, my own time, to do with as I will, as long as I am quiet, as long as I don't move, as long as I lie still." The difference between lie and lay. Lay is always passive. This is again interesting, and then she concludes this little section here. "But night is my time out. Where should I go? somewhere good. And then she starts to think about her past with Moira as they're studying for exams, I think in, I can't remember where that is. But so the night is just a time of freedom. And of course, it's also sort of like that, I mean, freedom to do things, but at the same time, not having any freedom at all. She's free to think as long as she's quiet, as long as she doesn't move, as long as she lies still, feigning sleep, basically. And she thinks back in this chapter 7, thinking back about her time in university, and thinking about her the men and women here protesting pornography and burning all these magazines, and teaching her as a young girl to throw these things into the fire, all that stuff. And she says after this point on the top of 39, she says, but then what happens? I know I lost time. There must have been needles, pills, something like that. I couldn't have lost that much time without help. You've had a shock, they said. I would come up through a roaring and a confusion, like surf boiling. I can remember feeling quite calm. I can remember screaming. It felt like screaming, though it may have only been a whisper. Where is she? What have you done with her? And there they see her. She has memories of her daughter, and she's also shown this picture of her daughter with new parents, of course, right? They're saying that she's with people who are fit. You are unfit, but you want the best for her, don't you? Right? Again, this brainwashing that occurs. And she's wearing a white dress. And who wears the white dresses? The daughters, right? The daughters of the wives and commanders. So here, unlike some of the other characters who become handmaids because they're fertile but not married, all that stuff, Alfred becomes a handmaid because she's tried to resist, right? She's tried to escape, we think, and she's brought back to become a handmaid, and her daughter is given away for adoption. And she remembers her daughter being taken away, and she says, I would like to believe this is a story I'm telling. I need to believe it. I must believe it. Those who can believe that such stories are only stories have a better chance. If it's a story I'm telling, then I have control over the ending. Then there will be an ending to the story, and real life will come after it. I can pick up where I left off. It isn't a story I'm telling. It's also a story I'm telling in my head as I go along. Tell rather than write, because I have nothing to write with, and writing is in any case forbidden. But if it's a story, even in my head, I must be telling it to someone. You don't tell a story only to yourself. There's always someone else, even when there is no one. And she says, the story's like a letter. Dear you, I'll say, just you, without a name. Attaching a name attaches you to the world of fact, which is riskier, more hazardous. Who knows what the chances are out there of survival? Yours. I will say you, like an old love song. You can mean more than one. You can mean thousands. I'm not in immediate danger, I'll say to you. I'll pretend you can hear me. But it's no good, because I know you can't. Now, this is an interesting passage here about how she wants this to be a story, to not be true. And she wants it not to be true so that it's a nightmare, it's something that will end, it's something that couldn't have happened, all that stuff. And yet, at the same time, it isn't a story, right? It is something that's happened to her. But there's also that idea here that she's telling it. She's recreating her past. Now, what is fascinating about the passage we just read? what's going on there? There's a detail that she mentions telling us about telling the story. First of all, the idea of you, right? That there's an audience that she's telling it to. And why do you think she'd write to an audience? Why do you think she's thinking about the audience? I'm going to give you a second and I'm going to put a question about that on the discussion board for you to answer. And then come back to this recording. The other question I have for you at the same time is, what do you make of what she slips in here, that she's writing this story to us, the reader, and yet, as you know, she doesn't have a pencil. She doesn't have anything to write it down on. So what does that mean? What are the implications of that? Sit down and write a response to that, and I'll pause your recording right now, and I will write the questions. I will pause this, and we'll come back to this in just a second. Thinking about these memories from her past, and these things are coming up, and there's gaps missing, and things that she can remember, and wondering what has been erased for her. Again, we have that motif, or that theme of the palimpsest, right, with her own memory, and also her own society, and her own city, really. Again, the physical location is also a palimpsest as well. Now, she wants this to be a story, both a story and not a story, because, of course, she doesn't want it to be true, right? And yet, it's not a story because it's frighteningly true. Now, storytelling winds up being a way, again, through language, right? Language that she's telling to herself first, and to us at some point. It becomes a way of using words to control her past and her future, and to really to take possession of her past and to think through that and figure out what it is, and possession for the sorry, I just lost my spot here, and a way of controlling her past and also the way her future is going to go. Now let's look at a few passages that deal with this, and one of these is on page 50. So flip to 50, and these are important passages throughout the book. And you also notice, speaking of words, there's this point in terms of her resistance or lack of resistance, this point on the page 49, where not that many pages after she said to us that she's resisting a situation by not using the word my or mine, the commander enters her room against custom, again a rebellion in some form or another, and she calls the room mine, right? She says, something has been shown to me, but what is it? Like the flag of an unknown country seen for an instant above the curve of a hill. It could mean attack, it could mean parley, it could mean the edge of something, a territory. The signals animals give one another, lowered blue eyelids, ears laid back, raised hackles, a flash of bare teeth. What in the hell does he think he's doing? Nobody else has seen him, I hope. Was he invading? Was he in my room? I called it mine. My room, then. There has to be some space, finally, that I claim as mine, even in this time. That's how chapter 9 begins. I'm waiting in my room, which is now a waiting room. Right? Listen to her playing with language again. When I go to bed, it's a bedroom. And she says, I am trying not to tell stories. Or at any rate, not this one. What does she mean by that? I'm trying not to tell stories. Or at any rate, not this one. Well, if you were thinking that she's meaning she's trying not to tell a lie, not to make up things about her situation there, then I think you'd be on the right track. But what could possibly cause her, just her description of her room there, to be something that is made up more than anything? Now, we have this moment of words again. This important indication that someone lived in the room before her, as we see this in chapter 9, the carving in the closet, right? Nolites bastardus carborundum, which of course is Latin. And then on page 54, she also sings to herself, right? And again, keeping these things for herself, hoarding these songs, the songs as a way of escaping. And there she's singing Amazing Grace, and she says that such songs are not sung in public anymore, especially the ones that use the words like free. They are considered too dangerous. They belong to outlawed sects. Now, as we get along here, we see another moment on page 66 where she's talking about the pat of butter, right? And she says, I wait, I compose myself. Myself is a thing I must now compose as one composes a speech. What I must present is a made thing, not something born. Now she's talking about trying to make it seem like she hasn't taken anything, trying to hide the butter she has taken away, all that kind of stuff. But there's also another meaning, perhaps, to this phrase. I compose myself. Myself is a thing I must now compose, as one composes a speech. In some ways, that's exactly what she's doing in telling her story, right? She's composing herself. She is creating an image of herself in the telling of the story that she's then passing along to other people. So this is an interesting passage here. Now, if we jump ahead a little bit to page 134, she's talking here prior to this about Moira and Lydia and that kind of thing. And then she says in 134, this is a reconstruction. All of it is a reconstruction. It's a reconstruction now in my head as I lie flat on my single bed rehearsing what I should or shouldn't have said, what I should or shouldn't have done, how I should have played it, if I can ever get out of here. And then she says further down, when I get out of here, if I'm ever able to set this down in any form, even in the form of one voice to another, it will be a reconstruction then too, at yet another remove. It's impossible to say a thing exactly as the way it was, because what you say can never be exact. You always have to leave something out. There are too many parts, sides, cross currents, nuances, too many gestures, which could mean this or that, too many shapes or objects, which can never fully can never be fully described. Too many flavors in the air on the tongue. Tongues. Tongue, half colors. Too many. But if you happen to be a man sometime in the future, if you've made it this far, please remember, you will never be subject to this temptation or feeling you must forgive a man. forgive a man as a woman. It's difficult to resist. Beat me to it. Or you believe me, or it's just believe me, it's difficult to resist. Now this is again really, really interesting, this passage about it being a reconstruction. It's a reconstruction twice removed, right? As she says, lying in her bed, even in the house, it's a reconstruction. And what happens when it's a reconstruction? What's going on there? Okay, now, on page 140, we have another passage at the end here, right? Where we have the commander, right? And her playing games with him. And she says, thinking about the sharp lever from the toilet that she could take out, hide it in her sleeve, and smuggle it into the commander's study the next time. I think about how I could approach the commander to kiss him here alone and take off his jacket. And then she'd drive the sharp end into him suddenly, between his ribs, excuse me. I think about all the blood coming out of him, hot as soup, sexual over my hands. In fact, I don't think about anything of the kind. I put it in only afterwards. Maybe I should have thought about that at the time, but I didn't. As I said, all of this is a reconstruction. All right, I said. I go to him and place my lips closed against his. I smell the shaving lotion, his usual kind, the hint of mothballs familiar enough to me. But he's like someone I've only just met. Now, she says, he draws away, looks down at me. Then there's the smile again, the sheepish one. Such candor. Not like that, he says, as if he meant it. He was so sad. That is a reconstruction, too. Right? Now, why would she reconstruct that in that way? Why would she want him to be sad? Or him to want to kiss her? As if she meant it. All those things. What does that all suggest to you? We have another night section, which is again a section of reflection, right, on what's happening to her and thinking about her past. She says on page 143, what I need is perspective, the illusion of depth created by a frame, the arrangement of shapes on a flat surface. Perspective is necessary, otherwise there are only two dimensions. Otherwise, you live with your face squished up against a wall, everything a huge foreground of details, close-ups, hairs, the weave of the bedsheet, the molecules of the face. Your own skin like a map, a diagram of futility, crisscrossed with tiny roads that lead nowhere. Otherwise, you live in the moment, which is not where I want to be. Obviously, right? She doesn't want to be in the moment that she's in. She's in the nighttime especially. But that's where I am. There's no escaping it. Time's a trap. And I'm caught in it. I must forget about my secret name and always back. My name is Ufford now, and here is where I live. Live in the present. Make the most of it. It's all you've got. And here is finally where we actually get some description about her. And we have this, some of these things about Aunt Lydia here in the following page. An interesting, again, thing that brings some of the things that she's saying into question, right? Again, to suddenly say halfway through the book, all of this is a reconstruction. Of course, anytime something's a reconstruction, there's room for error. And the question of who is reconstructing it, when are they reconstructing it, and why are they reconstructing it, as a matter of fact, become crucial to our interpretation of this text. Now, the other thing that is going on there is, from the very beginning, we seem to have this impression that our narrator is just telling things as they are. She's telling them these things as she sees it. We get very little background information or anything like that from the very beginning. And yet, we also have these moments, which for the reader can be sort of an epiphany, where suddenly she's revealing that she's reconstructing these things, maybe to the best of her ability, or maybe not, because here on 144, we get again another moment where she says she's lying. She made this up. She didn't experience things that she's describing them here. She talks about the commander, or no, Aunt Lydia again. On the top of 144, she says, "I can ask for something, possibly, not much, but something. Men are sex machines," said Aunt Lydia, "and not much more. They only want one thing. You must learn to manipulate them for your own good. Lead them around by the nose. That is a metaphor. It's nature's way. It's God's device. It's the way things are." Aunt Lydia did not actually say this, but it was implicit in everything she did say. It hovered over her head like the golden mottos of the saints of the Dark Ages. Like them, too, she was angular and without flesh. Right? Now, isn't that interesting, right? Tells us these things that Aunt Lydia says, and then says, well, but actually Aunt Lydia didn't say them, but it's sort of represented by her character and what she's experienced. And then she says, and asking how the commander fits into all this, right? And she says here, "He wanted to play Scrabble with me to play Scrabble with him and kiss him as if I meant it. That is one of the most bizarre things that's ever happened to me. That's happened to me ever. Context is all." But of course, she told us earlier that she made that up. That he wanted her to kiss him as if he meant it, or as if she meant it. And then we also have this line here: "Context is all," right? And the context we don't know, of course, is the context in which she's actually writing the story. Because she's not writing it while she's there in the house, right? She's told us this is a reconstruction twice removed, right? It's a reconstruction as she puts it together in her head. And then it's a reconstruction later as she's writing it down. Now, as we move further along after this question about perspective, we can move right to, as we get closer to the end of the book, there's an important passage here in 227. And where she's thinking about her past again. I believe this is another night section. And, yeah. Into the night section, and she says, thinking about her past, right, and what Moira and she had thought about relationships and those kinds of things in the early days. If it didn't work out, it was because one of you had the wrong attitude. Everything that went on in your life was thought to be due to some positive or negative power emanating from inside your head. And if you don't like it, change it, we said, to each other, to ourselves. And so we would change the man for another one. Change, we were sure, was for the better, always. We were revisionists. What we revised was ourselves. It's strange to remember how we used to think, as if everything were available to us, as if there were no contingencies, no boundaries, as if we were free to shape and reshape forever the ever-expanding perimeters of our lives. I was like that too. I did that too. Luke was not the first man for me, and he might not have been the last, if he hadn't been frozen that way, stopped dead in time, in midair, among the trees back there, in the act of falling. Again, a little question as to, you know, what's happened to Luke. In former times, they would send you a little package of belongings, what he had with him when he died. And he was the loved one, she says this later. Is, I say, is. Only two letters, you stupid shit. Can't you manage to remember it, even a short word like that? Again, the power of language, right? Putting something in the present tense rather than the past allows her to believe that Luke is still alive, right? And again, a really interesting question there, but we're always reshaping ourselves, right? We're always reshaping the past. And this question of revision, of course, seems innocent when they're talking about their own relationships and revising the man you're with, or revising yourself and the way you act or think about things. But of course, revision and reshaping the perimeters of their lives is exactly what the Gilead regime has done, right, with the people in their society. Burning memories and looking back comes when she's at Jezebel's and she talks to Moira. In the bottom of 243, she says, this is what she says, whispers more or less. I can't remember exactly because I had no way of writing it down. I filled it out for her as much as I can. We didn't have much time, so she just gave the outlines. Also, she told me this in two sessions. We managed a second break together. I've tried to make it sound as much like her as I can. It's a way of keeping her alive. Well, she tells this story here, right? But she's only given of Fred the Bear details. And she's saying, I can't remember it exactly because I had no way of writing it down. Well, she doesn't say this in so many words, but of course that's exactly the case of everything else she's writing down. She doesn't have, as it's happening, any vehicle through which to record this information, right? It's all in her memory. And if she can't remember the conversation here with Moira, likely she can't remember a lot of the other things that have happened to her here. And so then, from 243, let's move ahead to 250. And talking about Moira and Moira's fate there. And she says, here's what I'd like to tell. I'd like to tell a story about how Moira escaped for good this time. Or if I couldn't tell that, I'd like to say she blew up Jezebel's with 50 commanders inside it. I'd like her to end with something daring and spectacular, some outrage, something that would befit her. But as far as I know, that didn't happen. I don't know how she ended, or even if she did, because I never saw her again. And that's, again, this interesting point where she's, in this one scene, is admitting this sort of her own failings as trying to record things exactly. And here, of course, she has a lack of information. She can't tell exactly what happened to Moira. She never sees her again, all that kind of stuff. But again, pointing out to us that the narrative here has gaps, and there are things that she's had to fill in, things that she's had to make up, and things that she'll never be able to find out as well. Now, in chapter 40, on 261, we find more out about this notion of invention, right? And this is the scene with Nick. And she says, at the top of 261, near the top of 261, no preliminaries. He knows why I'm here. He doesn't even say anything. Why fool around? It's an assignment. And as she's describing this, she's saying, I can't wait. He's moving already. Love, it's been so long. I'm alive in my skin again, arms around him, falling and water softly everywhere, never ending. I knew it might only be once. I made that up. It didn't happen that way. Here's what happened. So then she's telling us a story again, and she gets there and they have a cigarette, and they have a conversation, and a longer narrative here about how their encounter goes. And then on the top of 263, she says, there wasn't any thunder, though. I added that in to cover the sounds, which I am ashamed of making. And then she says, after that, one will step further. It didn't happen that way either. I'm not sure how it happened, not exactly. All I can hope for is a reconstruction. The way love feels is always only approximate. Partway through, I thought about Serena Joy sitting down there in the kitchen, thinking, cheap. They'll spread their legs for anyone. All you need to do is give them a cigarette. And I thought afterwards, this is a betrayal. Not the thing itself, but my own response. If I knew for certain he's dead, would that make a difference? I would like to be without shame. I would like to be shameless. I would like to be ignorant. Then I would not know how ignorant I was. So, again, her shame and complicity in and participating there, not knowing if her husband's alive or not. But the other thing is, she says that this is inevitably a reconstruction, and she doesn't even remember how it actually went. But she follows that with a sentence about one of the things she thought about partway through, Serena Joy sitting at the kitchen table. There's obviously some pretty serious contradictions here and questions being raised about the truthfulness of this narrative. Now, on page 267, again, we get another indication of her feelings about the story and about herself in this. She says, "I wish this story were different. I wish it were more civilized. I wish it showed me in a better light, if not happier, then at least more active, less hesitant, less distracted by trivia. I wish it had more shape. I wish it were about love or sudden realizations important to one's life, or even about sunsets, birds, rainstorms, or snow." And she says, "I'm sorry there's so much pain in the story," as it goes along there. "I'm sorry it's in fragments, like a body caught in crossfire or pulled apart by force, but there's nothing I can do to change it. I've tried to put some of the good things in as well, flowers, for instance, because where would we be without them? Nevertheless, it hurts me to tell it over again. Once was enough, wasn't once enough for me at the time. But I keep going with this sad and hungry and sordid, this limping and mutilated story, because after all, I want you to hear it. And I will hear yours if I ever too get a chance." It's talking about this limping and mutilated story again. "Because after all, I want you to hear it, as I will hear yours too if I ever get the chance. If I meet you, or if you escape, in the future, or in heaven, or in prison, or the underground, some other place. What they have in common is that they're not here. But telling you anything at all, I'm at least believing in you. I believe you're there, I believe you into being. Because I'm telling you this story, I will your existence. I tell, therefore you are. So I will go on, so I will myself to go on. So I am coming to a part you will not like at all, because in it I did not behave well, but I will try nonetheless to leave nothing out. After all, you've been through. You deserve whatever I have left, which is not much, but includes the truth." Right? So it's not much, but it includes the truth. Not it is the truth, it includes the truth. There's truth here, but it's not all truth. And again, saying here that she is concerned about looking bad, she doesn't like how it shows her. She does reveal this moment of weakness at the end, and she says here, this is where she says, "I want to be there with Nick." And she says, telling this is on 271 in the middle of the page, "I'm ashamed of myself, but there's more to it than that. Even now I can recognize this admission as a kind of boasting, this pride in it, because it demonstrates how extreme and therefore justified it was for me, how well worth it. It's like stories of illness and near death from which you have recovered, like stories of war. They demonstrate seriousness." We have to sort of reconcile these ways in which she's telling stories here to help herself to survive, to believe that there's someone there who she will be able to tell the story to at some point in the future, keeping these stories in her head in order to sort of keep herself alive, and also, of course, to reconstruct her memories, right? But we have to reconcile that with the fact that there's so many admissions here throughout the book that there are things that she's making up, that there are things that she doesn't know, that she's turning into a narrative in order to entertain us or to keep us interested or what. It's not exactly clear. Now, and there are other things that she's invented some details, it seems, in Moira's own escape, those types of things. And as we get to the end, of course, she tells us and she admits to us sort of how far she has fallen, really, in the end, as she gives in and eventually wants to stay and wants to confess and turn people in, all that stuff, feeling their power. Fortunately, though, she's rescued, it seems. It's the last thing we find out. She is, the end of the book has the van coming to pick up Ufrid, right? And not knowing, of course, who is in the van, what's going on exactly. And as we see, the van waits in the driveway, its double doors stand open, the two of them on either side now. Take me by the elbows to help me in. Whether this is my end or a new beginning, I have no way of knowing. I've given myself over into the hands of strangers because it can't be helped. And so I step up into the darkness within, or else the light. Great way to end the story, and again, we don't know which is it, the darkness or the light that she winds up in. But fascinatingly, we have this again, this contrast that's been working throughout the book of the dark and the light, right? Both in terms of the day chapters and the night chapters. Is this into action or reflection, for that matter? And also the again, the colors of black and white that we see throughout the book, and the again, that line between sort of good and evil, as we see. Now, an interesting way to end the book, but Atwood doesn't stop there. And I think one of my the parts of the book that I like the most, even, is this historical notes section at the end. And this, in some ways, puts everything into perspective for us. Now, Atwood didn't need to do that, but she uses it to raise interesting questions. And we've just finished asking these questions about what's true and what's not true. What is she making up and what's she not making up? Well, if you'll remember, the I just have to find my notes here. The story, or the title of the academic paper that's being given about this text, The Handmaid's Tale, is called Problems of Authentication in reference to The Handmaid's Tale. So precisely the problems that we've been having as the reader is there in the academics reading of it 100 or 200 years after this has happened. And this is a book all about reading and storytelling. And I'm going to let you take a break, and I'm going to come back fairly quickly with a quick talk about the last historical notes section, because there's enough there that explains so much of what's going on in this book and shows why, in fact, I think it's just so brilliant. So that's it for now, and one more audio segment, and then we're done the book entirely.